simply by collecting up tin cans and empty bottles. We all want to believe it's true, but it don't matter what you do, so long as we continue to burn our way through fossils. Now it should come as no surprise to learn about the ocean's rise. Polar caps are melting with every year that the planet warms. Now people have to understand, we're gonna feel it far inland. It's gonna shift the seasons and supercharge the storms. King tide is a-coming, king tide is a-coming, king tide is a-coming, bringing flooding on a sunny day.
Good afternoon from listener-supported community radio, KKRN 88.5 FM. This is Wake Up Call, and I'm your host, Doug Craig. Our engineers today are Pete Marsh and Randy Compton. We're glad to have them with us. Couldn't do it without them. Wake Up Call is an effort to create a space through which the truth can shine. Our planet is undergoing unprecedented and massive transformation, while most of us are unaware of what this means. It is time to wake up to the climate crisis and accept our role as healers of the earth. I am super jazzed to welcome our special guest here today. We have Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, and she's an accomplished atmospheric scientist who studies climate change and why it matters to us here and now. She is also a remarkable communicator who has received the American Geophysical Union's Climate Communications Prize, the Stephen Schneider Climate Communications Award, and has been named to a number of lists, including Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People, Foreign Policy's 100 Leading Thinkers, and Fortune Magazine's World's Greatest Leaders. And last month, she received the Champion of the Earth Award, the UN's highest environmental honor. She's currently a professor and directs the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. Many people may know her as someone who's bridged the deep gap between scientists and Christians, work she does in part because she is a Christian herself. So we want to welcome you, Dr. Hayhoe, to the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Yep, we're really thrilled to have you. Let's just start off with a real basic question. You chose to pursue a PhD in atmospheric science, I believe, well before most people had even heard of global warming or climate change. How did you decide this was going to be your focus?
Well, growing up in Canada, I learned about climate change at a very early age. It's part of our educational system. But I was planning on being an astrophysicist, and I'd almost finished my undergraduate degree. I had been doing research already, collaborated with professors, and published a couple of papers. But I needed one extra course to finish my degree, and I'd already taken a lot of my other credits, and so I looked around, and I saw this course on climate science over in the geography department. I thought to myself, well, that looks interesting. I'd like to know more about this topic. So I took it, and that was what changed my career, because I realized for the first time that climate change is not just an environmental issue. I had always learned about it in the context of air pollution, biodiversity loss, deforestation, climate change. I viewed it as an environmental issue that people who are environmentalists care about, and the rest of us certainly hope will get fixed someday. But I didn't realize that it is what the U.S. military now calls it, a threat multiplier. It takes every issue we already care about, and it makes it worse. So here I was serendipitously the exact skill set that you needed to study climate science, which is a background in physics, and this big global problem that we need to fix. I mean, it's not the planet that's at risk, it's our civilization that's at risk, and a good portion of other living things on this planet. So when I realized that, I thought to myself, how can I not do everything I can to help solve this huge global problem? It's so urgent that surely we'll fix it soon, and I can go back to astrophysics. And that was a long time ago.
When was that exactly?
25 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. And you have come a long way. For our listeners who are not clear about the basics of human-caused climate change, how, when someone asks you, how do you answer the question about the climate change issue and how we know humans are responsible for it?
Well, we have a series of videos on YouTube called Global Weirding, not warming, but weirding. And we have 35 short videos, and all of them answer frequently asked questions. One of the biggest questions people have is, how do we actually know it's warming? And the answer is, we don't only look at thermometer data going back to the 1600s. We don't only look at satellite data going back to the 1960s and ocean buoys. We look at what we call natural thermometers. So we look at tree rings, ice cores, pollen records, even written records of when the cherry trees blossomed and when the harvest came and how often it froze. We look at historical records that go back thousands and even millions of years. And that's how we know that today the planet truly is warming. And it's warming at the fastest rate that we humans have experienced over the course of our civilization. That's why this is so important. It's not that the planet hasn't been warmer before. It has during, you know, anybody can watch Jurassic Park. But there weren't 8 billion humans on the planet at that time. So the reason we care about changing climate is because our civilization is built, predicated on a very stable climate. We have local, regional ups and downs, like the medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age, which were very regional variations. But we've never seen something as big and as fast as this. So then the second question people have, and we have a Global Weirding episode on this too, is how do we know it's not a natural cycle? Well, what many people don't realize is we scientists are the very ones who study natural cycles. We study the influence of the sun and volcanoes on Earth's climate. So when we see the planet warming, we don't immediately jump on the bandwagon and start running around saying, oh, it must be humans, it must be humans. We look at all of the natural factors that have caused climate to change in the past. And when we look at the sun, we know that over the last 40, 50 years, the sun's energy has actually been going down, not up. So if our temperature were responding only to the sun's energy, we'd be getting cooler, not warmer. With natural cycles like El Nino, what they do is they move heat around the climate system from east to west, north to south, ocean to atmosphere, and back again. So if our planet were warming due to a natural cycle like El Nino, some other part of the planet would have to be cooling. But when we look at the entire planet, we look at the ocean, we look at the land surface, we look at the ice, we look at the atmosphere, it is all warming. And that's how we know it can't be a natural cycle. But then people say, well, isn't there some type of other natural cycle outside the Earth's climate system? And the answer is yes, there is. There are the orbital cycles that cause the ice ages and the warm periods like we're in today. So then we might say, well, aren't we just getting warmer after the last ice age? We can look at where we are in these orbital cycles. They're very periodic. They're very regular. They're actually very easy to predict. And according to those orbital cycles, warming after the last ice age should have peaked about 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. And the next thing on our geologic calendar should be another ice age somewhere in the next 1,500 years. So when we look at the natural thermometer data, we see that that is exactly what happened. Warming after the last ice age peaked about the dawn of human civilization. So when we were developing agriculture and cities and writing systems and transportation and economies, that was when we had the most warming. And since then, the planet was very, very, very gradually cooling until the Industrial Revolution, when all of a sudden our temperature shot straight up again. And then we can look at things like volcanoes, but major volcanic eruptions produce particles that cool the Earth. So after a volcanic eruption, we have a year or two of cool weather. And although geologic activity, not so much volcanoes, but other things like leaks and seeps and mud volcanoes and submarine volcanoes, although they do produce heat-trapping gases, they just produce a fraction of the heat-trapping gases that humans produce. So we go through all of the natural suspects, and we know today that every natural suspect has an alibi. The only thing that could be causing the planet to warm, like we're seeing today, are human emissions of heat-trapping gases. About 75% of those come from digging up and burning coal, gas, and oil, and about 25% come from deforestation, agriculture, and land use.
In the last decade, Catherine, and that was excellent, by the way, that really tied it up really nicely. In the last decade, you have become one of the most effective climate science communicators on the planet, and you devote a tremendous amount of your time, which I have to believe you're not compensated always.
My outreach program is 0% funded. Yeah. I do it volunteer.
That's wonderful, which kind of puts to rest the argument that scientists are in it just for the money. Clearly, you aren't, and I know all the IPCC scientists devote their time for that.
It's all volunteer, too, and the work on the National Climate Assessment is also volunteer, but unfortunately, it doesn't put this argument to rest. I hear it at least once a week. Oh, you're just making it up for the money. So, as you might guess, we have a global weirding episode on that. Our scientists just in it for the money. And it's a very funny one, so I would encourage everybody to watch that episode because it is a frequent myth that is never going to go away. But you know what it is? It's actually, I think, it's a form of projection. So in other words, people accuse us of doing what they would or are doing themselves. And a classic example was when the fourth U.S. National Climate Assessment came out a year ago last Thanksgiving. I was one of the lead authors. I had devoted hundreds of unpaid hours, mostly nights and weekends, to working on the National Climate Assessment. And I'm not even a U.S. citizen. Most other authors were. So I had devoted all of this time. And on CNN, when they were discussing the National Climate Assessment, they had Rick Santorum on to talk about it. And Rick Santorum said, oh, you know, those scientists, they're just doing it for the money. Well, guess who pays him? He's in the pay of the coal industry. So it was 100% projection that he was accusing us of doing what he is actually doing himself. Yeah. Talk about irony.
Yep, hypocrisy. You're coming to California, I believe, between the 5th and 7th of November, and you'll be speaking at UC Davis, Berkeley, and Stanford. Can you tell us how our listeners might be able to come hear you speak, or is that just for the students at the schools?
Oh, no. So whenever I do travel, about 80% of my talks, though, I give remotely because travel is the biggest part of my carbon footprint. So I give about 80% remotely, but when I do travel, I try to group as many events together as I can. I don't fly somewhere just to do one event. I try to do multiple meetings, talks, teach classes, give lectures, everything I can do. So I'm really excited that I am going to be coming to Northern California the first week in November. And I am doing a ton of events, and one of them at each school I'm visiting is open to the public. So on Tuesday, November 5th, I'm going to be at UC Davis. I'm going to be giving the John Muir Lecture at 5 p.m. On Wednesday, November 6th, I'm going to be at the University of California, Berkeley, and I'm going to be giving a public talk there at 4 p.m. And then on Thursday, November 7th, I'm going to be at Stanford. And there, I'm going to be having a conversation with Chris Field, who is a very well-known scientist and ecologist who's been studying climate change and leading IPCC reports for decades. And our conversation is going to happen from 3:30 to 5 p.m. So it's 5 o'clock at UC Davis on Tuesday, 4 o'clock at Berkeley on Wednesday, and 3:30 at Stanford on November 7th, which is a Thursday. And if anyone's looking for more information on my Facebook page, which is just my name, Catherine Hayhoe, on my Facebook page, I have all of these listed as events, and I also have a lot of other events I do, both online virtual events as well as in-person events that people can find out more about.
So everyone listen and tune into the Facebook page to get all that information, and then your Global Weirding series is on YouTube, right?
That's right.
So there's tons of information. They're really short, fun, informative, and I recommend them highly. So in your talks that you're planning to give, what is your main message that you want people to understand about our changing climate?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have one specific talk that I give. I have about 20, 25 now different templates of talks that, depending on where I'm at and who I'm talking to, that I would give. So each talk that I give at Davis, Berkeley, and Stanford is actually going to be different. So I hate to say that because then some people are going to be like, oh, well, I wish I could attend them all. But that's why I have a lot of my talks actually recorded on my YouTube channel. So in addition to Global Weirding, I also have a YouTube channel where a lot of the lectures I've given have been recorded, so people can go there if they want more. But when I do speak to people, especially people who may not necessarily know why this connects to their lives, I want to unpack what I think are two of the most dangerous myths that the largest number of people have bought into. Now, in the news, we hear a lot about how, oh, people don't think the science is real, or people think the science is a matter of opinion. And that absolutely is a dangerous myth, for sure, because science is not a matter of opinion. You can't just say, oh, I don't believe in gravity and step off the cliff, because whether you believe in it or not, you're going down. You can't say, well, I don't believe that the planet is warming. It is warming. The only difference is, are you going to be prepared, or are you going to be totally unprepared for the impact? So even though those are dangerous myths, though, the most widespread dangerous myth that the largest number of people have bought into are not that the science is somehow optional or up for debate. The two biggest myths that we've bought into are that we don't think this matters to us personally. We agree that climate change will affect future generations. We also agree all across the U.S., including California, that it will affect plants and animals and people in developing countries. Most of us think that it will affect people in the United States. But then do you think it will affect you personally? And the answer is no. We don't think it matters to us personally. And if you're wondering where that data comes from, it comes from a great public opinion survey called the Yale Climate Opinion Maps. So if you just go online and you Google Yale Climate Opinion 2018, you can find people's answers to about 25 different questions related to climate science, impacts, and solutions online, and they have the numbers by county and by congressional district. So you can zoom in exactly on where you live, the county you live, or the congressional district you live. But you will see that all across the country, do you think you're personally affected by climate change? Most people say no. So we don't think the impacts pose a threat to us personally. That's the first most dangerous myth. And then the second most dangerous myth that the largest number of people have bought into is the myth that the solutions do pose an imminent threat to us. The solutions are negative. They're punitive. The only solutions are to destroy the economy or let the government control our personal choices. And most people say, well, if those are the only solutions, then I don't want to fix this problem. So that's why it's so important to not only talk about how climate change matters to us in the places where we live, but it's also really important to talk about what are some viable, practical, positive, beneficial solutions to a changing climate that we can get behind, that we can engage in ourselves, that we can support, and that we can encourage the leaders in our community, in our state, and our country to get behind.
So you have a Facebook page, you have a YouTube channel, and you've given a TED Talk. And in your TED Talk, you said one of the most important solutions to the climate crisis is everyday people just talking to one another about it. Why are people so afraid to talk about the climate crisis?
We're afraid to talk about it, I think, for two reasons. First of all, we're worried that whoever we talk to is going to not agree with us, and we might end up in an argument. And unless we're the type of people who enjoy arguments, we're kind of afraid to kind of start something like that. And then the second thing we're afraid of is that it's just going to be really depressing because we're going to be talking about a horrible problem with nothing that we can do about it to fix it. So that's why when they asked me to do a TED Talk, I decided I was going to do a TED Talk on how the most important thing we can do about a changing climate is talk about it. Because on those Yale climate opinion maps, when they asked people, do you think it matters to you? And most people answered no. That was not the most negative answer. The most negative answer was, do you ever talk about it or hear anybody else talk about it? So if you never talk about it, why would you think it matters? And if you don't think it matters, why would you think you could fix it? So that's why it's so important to understand the two biggest myths that we believe. We don't think it matters to us, and we don't think we can fix it. And of course, those are totally false. So let's look at California. If we live in California, how does climate change affect us personally in California? Well, one of the biggest ways that we're affected in California, as well as in Texas where I live, is the fact that climate change is loading the weather dice against us. What do I mean by that? Well, wherever we live, we always have a chance of rolling a double six. That's a drought, a heat wave, a flood, a landslide, a winter storm. We always have a chance of rolling a double six naturally. That's just part of weather on this planet. But as the planet warms decade by decade by decade, it's like it's sneaking in and taking one of those numbers on our dice and replacing it with a six, and then another six, and then it's replacing it with a seven. And all of a sudden, we're rolling double sixes and double sevens, and we're like, where are these coming from? How could the city of Houston, some places in the city of Houston, how could they be experiencing 3, 4, or even 5 500-year flood events in 10 years? That's not a 500-year flood event when you have 3, 4, or 5 of them in 10 years. That's a 2, 3, or 4 year flood event at that point. So climate change is loading the dice against us, making many of our naturally occurring weather and climate events stronger, more frequent, more intense, or longer. So specifically, what's happening in California? Well, California is naturally vulnerable to droughts. We know, going back in the paleoclimate record for not just decades, but centuries, even millennia, we know that mega droughts are part of California's history. But we also know that the warmer it is, it reinforces pre-existing droughts. So although the occurrence of the last California drought that started in 2010, the occurrence was very likely natural, it was occurring in a warmer world where temperatures were warmer, evaporation rates were speeding up. These things reinforce what they call the ridiculously resilient ridge of high pressure that was sitting over California already as a result of the drought, directing storms away from the state. This ridge was reinforced, made stronger and longer lasting because it was occurring in a warmer world. So did climate change cause the California drought? No. Did it make it stronger and a lot worse than it would have been otherwise? The answer is yes. We see something similar in Texas. Does climate change cause hurricanes? No. But with Hurricane Harvey, we know that it was bigger, it was stronger, and it had a lot more rainfall associated with it. In the case of Hurricane Harvey, almost 40% more rain than it would have had if the same hurricane had occurred 50 or 100 years ago. In California, we also know that wildfires are a natural part of the ecosystem. And without a changing climate across the whole U.S., since the 1980s, there would have been about 11 million acres burned by wildfire naturally. We also know that the number of wildfires is not increasing. Wildfires are primarily the result of human ignition, and the number of wildfires has been pretty stable over the last couple of decades. So does that mean that climate change is not affecting wildfires? No, not at all. If we look at the area that's actually been burned by wildfires, it has been more than double what you'd expect without a changing climate. Why? Because when those wildfires start, the hotter and drier conditions are leading to more intense wildfires that spread more quickly, that burn greater area, and that are much more dangerous. So climate change is exacerbating the area burned by wildfires. It is making drought stronger and longer, and we're not done yet. There's two more, at least. There's actually probably a few more, but there's two more big important ones. Climate change is also increasing the risk of heavy precipitation events. Because when we don't have a drought, we have atmospheric rivers, which are like rivers in the sky, that bring massive amounts of rain to California. And we know that in a warmer world, those atmospheric rivers are getting stronger and more intense with more rainfall associated with them. So when it isn't a drought, our heavy rainfall is getting more intense and more frequent, which leads, of course, to flooding and to devastating landslides along coastal California. And then we also know that long-term increases in heat are also affecting the state. How? Well, a couple of different ways. First of all, California gets about half of its water supply from snowpack. California is a Mediterranean climate, which means that most precipitation falls in the winter. But California has the Sierra Nevada Mountains, which act as a natural reservoir, collecting winter precipitation as snow, and then it melts and thaws in spring just when the Central Valley needs it for irrigation. Well, what's happening is, as it gets warmer, more of the winter precipitation is falling as rain and less is falling as snow. When it falls as rain, it just runs away into the ocean. It's not collected in a reservoir waiting for when we need it. We're also seeing that the timing of snowmelt has shifted already by at least 3 weeks earlier in the year, which plays havoc with the allocations of water of farmers who have been farming the Central Valley for generations. And we also know that warmer weather speeds up air pollution. It speeds up the chemical reactions that cause ground-level ozone. And we know that air pollution is already a terrible problem in many areas in California, especially in L.A. And as the world warms, it's getting worse, too. So California California is one of the most vulnerable states in the country to the impacts of a changing climate. And today, looking at the fact that PG&E was shutting off people's power because they were afraid it was going to spark a wildfire, and then there was all cascading impacts from the fire weather that we're experiencing in recent weeks, we can see how climate change is affecting us in the place where we live. It's no longer about the polar bear. It's no longer about the future. It is happening right here today in California.
If you're just tuning in, this is Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5 FM listener-supported radio. I'm Doug Craig, and the host of this show, and my guest today is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. So last weekend, I talked about the climate crisis in a sermon I gave at the United Church of Christ. That was in West Liberty, Ohio, near Dayton. And every time I give a talk like this, I know the audience wants to know what the solutions are or what they can do. And I always find this to be the hardest part of doing these talks because there isn't a simple, single answer to solving this crisis. How do you answer that when people ask you what the solution is? How do you respond?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is exactly what happened to me. So when I first started giving talks, people had a lot of questions about the science. So I would go out, every time I gave a talk, I would say, okay, I would go out and I would find the answers to the questions I got, and then I would revise my presentation before I gave it again to make sure I was answering the questions people had. And then I would get more questions about why does this matter to us, and so I would go out and include that in my presentation, go back, talk about why it matters to us. And then eventually, after going through this probably, you know, 8, 10, 12 times, I got to the point where I was answering most of people's questions about the science and about how this matters to us. Then all the questions that I was getting is, what are we supposed to do about it? And when I first got those questions over a decade ago, when I first started giving a lot of public talks, I was floored because I felt like, well, I'm a scientist. I mean, we diagnose the heck out of the problem. We can tell you exactly how bad it is, exactly how it's going to affect you, but we're not engineers, we're not innovators, we're not business people, we're not, policy experts. We don't design legislation, we don't create new technology. That's not what we scientists do. So I was really stymied by that question, but I felt like it's irresponsible of me, and really I feel like this is in general, it's irresponsible of all of us to talk about a problem without offering people solutions. Because if you talk about a problem without any hope of how we can fix it, what are we doing? All we're doing is just scaring people without any positive information on what we could do to fix it. So I felt like, okay, I have to go out and I have to figure out what we can do. I have to answer this question myself. So I went out and I thought about it. And the first thing I thought is, well, the obvious thing individually is for us to step on a carbon calculator. If you're going to lose weight, the first thing you do is you step on the scale, you figure out, you know, how much you weigh, and then you look at a diet program and figure out how you're going to get to your goal. So a carbon footprint calculator does the same thing. If you just go online and Google carbon footprint calculator, there's a lot of good ones out there. There's one actually that UC Berkeley runs called Cool Climate, I think. And you enter, you know, where you live, how big your house is, how many people live with you, how much meat you eat, have you changed your light bulbs, how do you dry your clothes, how far do you drive, you know, how often do you fly every year. And it tells you what your carbon footprint is, and then it also tells you what you can do personally to reduce your carbon footprint. Because depending on your lifestyle, the biggest thing for your buck might be eating lower down the food chain, having some meatless days each week, or it might be looking at how you commute, getting a more efficient car, or looking to telecommute one day a week, or carpool, or take public transit. Or for me, it was flying, because as scientists, we fly a lot of places, and so that's why I decided I was going to reduce my carbon footprint by transitioning about 80% of the events I do to virtual events, and by only traveling after that when I group all my activities together. So I'm not flying someplace to just do one thing. I've got 5, 10, 15, 18. My record actually from just a few weeks ago was 30 events when I went to Alaska for 5 days. That was a pretty efficient use of my carbon footprint. But then when I started to think about this a little bit more, I realized, well, that's actually not enough, because our personal decisions only control a fraction of global emissions. I mean, even if everyone in the world went vegan, that's only 14% of global emissions. So what more could we do? And that's when I realized, well, we have to be able to inform ourselves about and advocate also for system-wide changes, because we need system-wide change. And Project Drawdown, which you can find online at drawdown.org. Project Drawdown is a fantastic resource because they list almost 100 different solutions to climate change. And I love their solutions because, of course, you know, they have wind and solar and all that on their list. But they also have things like reducing food waste and regenerative agriculture, educating women and girls, bike lanes. They have the most amazing systematic, system-wide changes on their list that we can learn about and we can share with people. So what I gradually began to realize, both through talking with people, through struggling with this tension between the fact that individual actions are not enough to solve this problem, we need system-wide change, and then looking at the Yale climate opinion maps, which show us that the question that the most people across the U.S. answer no to is, do you ever talk about this issue? That's when I grew to finally realize that the most important thing that any single person can do about a changing climate is talk about it. Because if we don't talk about it, how would we understand that it matters to us? And if we don't know why it matters to us, why would we ever want to fix it? So talking about how it matters and what we can do to fix it is the single most important thing that every single person can do in this world, and that's what you and I are doing right now.
If you're just tuning in, this is Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5 FM, listener-supported radio. I'm Doug Craig. Our guest today is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, and we'll be right back after this break.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could save the world and all simply by collecting up tin cans and empty bottles? We all want to believe it's true, but it don't matter what you do, so long as we continue to burn our way through fossils. Now it should come as no surprise to learn about the ocean's rise. Polar caps are melting with every year that the planet warms. Now people have to understand, we're gonna feel it far inland. It's gonna shift the seasons and supercharge the storms. King tide is a-coming, king tide is a-coming, king tide is a-coming, bringing flooding on a sunny day.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Doug Craig on Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5 FM. We are super thrilled to have Dr. Catherine Hayhoe as our guest today. And Dr. Hayhoe, we are broadcasting from Redding, one of the most conservative cities in California. And as you're probably aware, we lost over 1,000 homes in the car fire in July of 2018, and then a few months later, 85 people tragically died in the campfire in Paradise, which is only 75 miles from here. Now, as you said a moment ago, the science is clear that wildfires are much worse now because of the climate crisis, but we have a congressman who's a climate science denier, and no public official in our region feels safe publicly admitting the reality of climate change. You live in Texas, which is a red state, and you must deal with this all the time. What advice can you give those of us who want our leaders to talk more openly about this reality?
Yes, I live in Texas, so I've experienced probably anything and everything that everybody else has too. And what I have found is something really interesting, and that is that climate change and global warming have become the most politically polarized topics in the entire United States. So, in other words, it's become part of people's identity to reject those terms and the reality of those terms. But what I've found in Texas, and I'm sure this is also true in California, is that when we talk more specifically about the fact that wildfires are getting more dangerous, and it's getting warmer, and that's affecting our water resources. And, wow, that last drought was really a killer. It was unusually hot and dry. When we talk about things like climate variability, when we talk about even things like long-term trends, people can get on board with that, surprising people. So I had an experience a couple of years ago where I was asked to speak to a large group of water managers in Texas. I was the third speaker in the session. The first speaker was a state representative who rejects the reality of a changing climate. The second was the head of a state agency that rejects the reality of a changing climate. And then there was me. Well, you know, I can't exactly hide the fact that I'm a climate scientist. I am. That's what I'm introduced as. But what I did was I talked all about climate variability and long-term trends, both historical and future. I showed how it's getting warmer, how the future depends on our choices, how we have to adapt and prepare if we're going to have resilient water systems in the future. And I did it all without mentioning the words climate and change together, although that was exactly what I was talking about. Afterwards, first of all, everybody clapped and nobody threw tomatoes. That was a plus. But then I will never forget, this woman came running up to me afterwards and she grabbed my hand. She shook my hand. She said, "That was fantastic. I agree with everything you said. Those people who talk about global warming, I don't agree with them at all. But this makes sense."
Crazy. And
then I just had another experience just the other day, again, working with the water district, where we actually looked at data for the water district to show how as it gets hotter and warmer, their evaporation rates are going to increase from their surface reservoirs, and so they're going to have to prepare for some serious changes in water supply. And their board is very, very conservative. They're not at all on board with the idea that climate is changing. And in fact, one of them was saying, you know, my granddaughter comes home from school and they've told her that the polar bears are endangered. And I try to tell her that's not true, but she won't listen to me. And then, hardly without taking a breath, he continued, "But the data is the data. And you've shown us the data. So we have to go with what the data says for our water region, because this is what the data says." So there's tremendous power in bringing things down to the local and regional scale, at talking specifically about what is happening in the places where we live, and talking about positive, beneficial solutions that we can get on board with. Because frankly, if a farmer here in West Texas is putting wind turbines on his land, but he doesn't agree that global warming is real, I don't care, because he's putting wind turbines on his land. He's doing it because he gets the check in the mail, but he's also cutting carbon emissions at the same time. We don't all have to agree on everything to agree that building resilience and investing in clean energy helps us all.
Many of us have stereotypes of scientists as being non-religious or even being atheists or agnostics, while religious people are often considered to be anti-science. The reality is that people can possess a religious belief or faith and also be science-minded. As a daughter of Christian missionaries and the wife of an evangelical Christian pastor, Andrew Farley, and the you two wrote a book a few years ago titled "A Climate for Change: Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions." You have no trouble bridging the religious and scientific worlds. What do you say to people who have trouble understanding this?
Well, interestingly, I have a friend and a colleague called Elaine Eklund, and she's a sociologist who studies science and religion. So a number of years ago, she did a survey because she also heard the idea that we all hear, you know, those scientists, they're all godless liberal atheists. And she thought to herself, being a sociologist, she thought, is that true? So she interviewed 1,700 scientists at top research universities around the entire United States. And what she found completely explodes that myth. She found that 50% of us identify with a specific religious label. So 50% of us would say, I am a, you know, Christian, I am a Hindu, I am Buddhist, I am a Jew, I am Muslim, 50% of us. She found that 70% of us view ourselves as spiritual people. In other words, we believe that there is more than what just science can observe and document. 70%. And then what was really fascinating, of the remaining 30% who are atheists, she found that 20% of those atheists view themselves as spiritual atheists, which is really interesting. So the whole idea that scientists don't think there's anything more to this life than we can observe or measure with science is actually completely false. And I have a list of, you know, dozens, actually probably a couple hundred, of us scientists who are Christians who do what we do because we're Christians, because we care about this planet. We care about every living thing on it. We care about our sisters and our brothers, every single human around the world, especially the poorest and most vulnerable among us who are being disproportionately affected by the impacts of a changing climate. So there really is not a tension between science and faith. But then you might say, okay, but when you look at public opinion on climate change, and the American Association of Religion did this a couple of years ago, and you divide out people's opinion on, do you think climate is changing? Are humans responsible? Are you concerned or worried about climate change? You divide out people's answers by religious affiliation. It turns out that the two groups at the very bottom, in terms of the lowest level of acceptance of the science and the lowest level of concern about a changing climate, are white evangelical Protestants and white Catholics. So then people say, well, there's got to be something about the doctrine that you're believing that would put you at the bottom of this list. But the key there, unfortunately, I hate to say, is in the first word I said. Because when you look at black Protestants and when you look at Hispanic Catholics, those two people groups are some of the most concerned about the impacts of a changing climate. And they read the same Bible. Hispanic Catholics and white Catholics have the same Pope. The Pope wrote the encyclical about how climate change is a very serious issue and it connects directly to our Christian values. So when other social scientists have dug more deeply into this, what they found is it isn't anything to do with Christian doctrine, even though people tend to use religiously sounding excuses like, oh, the world's going to end anyways and God is in control. It's nothing actually to do with Christian doctrine, because the Bible is very clear that we have responsibility over every living thing on this planet. But what it is the fact that in the United States, and this is really unique to the United States, religion and politics have become so intertwined that many of the people who call themselves evangelical and even Catholic today, their statement of faith is written first by their political ideology and only a distant second by the Bible. And if the two come into conflict, they will go with their political ideology over the Bible. In fact, one survey I read showed that about half of the people who voted for President Trump, who self-identify as evangelical, about half of them don't even go to church. So sociologists have coined this term, which I think is really incredibly accurate. I used to call it political Christianity, but what they call it is they call it therapeutic moral deism. So let's unpack that a little bit. They're suggesting that a large number of people in the United States believe in a God to whom they ascribe their own moral code that makes them feel good about who they are and what they believe. So many people, unfortunately, who are calling themselves Christians wouldn't recognize a verse from the Bible if they were presented with it. So the conflict is not between what they say they believe and understanding that humans are affecting climate, the impacts are serious and we need to act. The conflict is between what they actually believe, which has everything to do with political ideology and pretty much nothing to do with the Bible.
If you're just tuning in, this is Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5 FM, listener-supported radio. I'm Doug Craig. Our guest today is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. And just to follow up with what you're saying, it's also important to understand that almost every church and religious organization on the planet has issued a statement supporting the scientific consensus on climate change. So, you know, it is a myth that that religious organizations, anyway, are not in support of scientific reality as it pertains to climate change.
If I may add, what a lot of people don't realize is that 4 years before the Pope's encyclical, the U.S. National Association of Evangelicals published a report called Loving the Least of These that directly connects the dots between climate change and its impacts on the poor, 4 years before the encyclical.
Yeah, and I think way back in 2007, I believe that there was an evangelical organization that issued a statement. I think 85 prominent mm-hmm. pastors in the nation signed on to that. Your colleague and fellow climate scientist, John Holdren, said, "We basically have three choices: mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. We're going to do some of each. The question is what the mix is going to be. The more mitigation we do, the less adaptation will be required, and the less suffering there will be." Can you help our listeners understand what he meant by this?
Yes. That is one of my favorite quotes, and that's why I include it on my website, because if you can still believe it, people still today are arguing whether we should adapt or mitigate. So should we just prepare for the impact of a changing climate, or should we reduce our carbon emissions? And I'm like, people, the answer to that question is yes. We need to do both as much as possible, as soon as possible. And if we don't reduce our emissions, if we don't prepare for the impacts of a changing climate, there's only one alternative, and that is a word that scientists typically don't use, but it is a word that we're recognizing is increasingly important, and that is we are going to suffer. So what is mitigation? Mitigation is cutting down our carbon emissions, looking for other ways to get energy that don't produce carbon, and the good news is that in California, solar plus storage, because, of course, the sun doesn't shine at night. Solar plus storage is cheaper than natural gas. LA just signed a new contract because that was the cheapest source of energy. So we have to reduce our carbon emissions. We also have to draw carbon down out of the atmosphere through smart agricultural practices, planting trees, and even innovative new technology that sucks carbon out of the atmosphere and turns it into liquid fuels. But we also have to prepare for the impacts of a changing climate, because some of the impacts are here today, and some of them are inevitable, even if we could flip a magic switch tomorrow and turn all our carbon off. So we have to build resilience to the impacts we can't avoid. We have to reduce our emissions to avoid the impacts that we can. And if we don't do that, we will suffer. And here's the most unfair thing about it. The people who suffer the most are the people who did the least to contribute to the problem in the first place.
And we should all pay attention to that. To those of us who've been studying this issue over the years, the truth seems so evident and the need for action so obvious. You know, you've touched on this in some of your other answers, but, you know, why are people in denial about the fact? I mean, it seems so obvious if we look around. Is it just because the political ideology just trumps observational reality?
It does. And in fact, they've even done studies, for example, in New Hampshire when they had an unusually warm winter. And then after January and February, they asked people, was January in New Hampshire unusually warm? And it was 8 degrees warmer than the average. That's pretty warm. And the answer depended on who you voted for in the last election. Only 50% of people who voted for Trump agreed that it was warmer than average, whereas people who didn't vote for Trump, most of those agreed that, yes, in fact, it was warmer than average. So political ideology does actually, I'm sorry to say, trump the evidence of our own eyes, because we've gotten to the point where somehow who we vote for, who sits in a White House in Washington, has become a more important part of our identity than our own experiences, what our five senses are telling us. And the bottom line, the fundamental reason for that is fear. It's fear. We fear that climate solutions will harm us. We fear that the world is changing too quickly and we're going to be left behind and we're going to be suffering as a result. So we are fearing what the solutions bring, whereas what we really should be fearing is what the impacts are.
And to shift a little bit, there's another reality that we don't always hear about, and they're sometimes referred to as positive feedback loops. That the more we warm the planet, the more we trigger events that increase warming. Can you give us some examples of those, and in particular any that you're especially concerned about?
Sure. So I think that positive feedback effect is a bit of a misnomer, because, you know, if you get positive feedback from your teacher, that means you did well. If you get positive feedback from your loan officer, it means that, you know, you've got some good ideas on how to get a loan. So what I prefer to call them is vicious cycles. Or in science, we call them self-amplifying feedbacks. In other words, the idea that we humans might cause a little bit of warming, and then the way the climate system responds to that is by adding to that warming. A classic example is in the Arctic. So as the Arctic warms, shiny white reflective snow and ice is melting, exposing dark land or dark ocean underneath. And darker land or ocean absorbs a lot more of the sun's energy than shiny white reflective snow or ice. So in other words, as the Arctic warms, it's absorbing more and more of the sun's energy as more dark surface is exposed, and that means it's warming up even more. That is one of the classic vicious cycles in the climate system that is currently causing the Arctic to warm twice as fast as the rest of the world.
What do you view as the very, very best and the very, very worst case scenarios moving forward?
The very best scenario, I think, is one where we not only wean ourselves off carbon as soon as possible within our lifetime, but we also figure out how to draw a lot of it back down out of the atmosphere. That is our only chance of remaining at or below 1.5 degrees. But here's the thing. There is no magic number. So, you know, 1.499999 degrees is not fine, and then 1.5001 degrees, you know, it's all over, we're going to hell in a handbasket. There is no magic threshold or number. Every gigaton of carbon we cut helps us. So just because, you know, people might say, well, oh, we can't make 1.5 degrees anymore. Well, what if we make 1.6? What if we make 1.7? What if we make 1.8? Everything's better than nothing. The worst case scenario is if we continue to depend on fossil fuels as we currently do through the end of the century, it wouldn't mean the end of the planet. The planet's seen warmer conditions before. It would mean the end of civilization as we know it. Because our food systems, our water systems, our energy systems, our distribution of natural resources, 2/3 of the world's cities within a few feet of sea level, 700 million people living in the low elevation coastal zone, we are not prepared for multiple feet of sea level rise, for stronger droughts, wildfires burning greater area, supersized hurricanes. It is our public systems that would break down under a changing climate if we continue on our current pathway. That is what is at risk.
The fact that we've pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, how important is that in your view?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, technically the U.S. has not yet pulled out. It's not federally, it's not doing anything to meet the target, but there's a waiting time before you can leave, and the waiting time actually ends next November, right before the next federal election. Now, there's also a movement called We Are Still In, and that movement, which is made up of states, cities, businesses, organizations, seminaries, native tribes, over 40% of the U.S. is still in on the Paris Agreement, and they're actually taking meaningful action to meet their targets, whereas my country of Canada is still in on the Paris Agreement, but there's serious doubt whether we're going to meet our targets. So when you actually look at what's happening in the U.S., it's not nearly as depressing as you might think. But do we need federal action? We absolutely do need federal action. And that's why, after talking about it, voting is the number one thing that each one of us can do to affect long-term change.
What gives you hope when this issue seems so overwhelming to so many of us?
Well, what gives you hope is probably the most frequent question that I've gotten over the past few years. And the answer to that is, first of all, it's not the science. Definitely not the science. Every new study that comes out seems like it's changing faster to a greater extent than we thought. It's not the politics of it either. I mean, I try to avoid reading what the politics says about a changing climate because it's so depressing and about the lack of federal climate policy. But what does give me hope is looking at what people are doing, because there are incredible things happening all around. And so on my social media accounts, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, I try to share good news and hopeful stories so that people can understand that the world is changing. Individuals can make a difference. The kids' climate strikes, the new technology that's being developed, the fact that we have ways to get energy that don't produce heat-trapping gases, that we can figure out how to suck it out of the atmosphere, that we can change our lives for the better, and that this change will be good for us, not bad. There is a lot of good news, and so hope is not a passive emotion. We have to go out and we have to look for hope. When we go out and look for hope, we will find it, and then what we need to do is we need to share it with everyone we can through talking about it.
Is there any current politician that has a climate plan that you think is on target?
Well, so our Canadian election is coming up very soon, and I've analyzed all of our party's targets. And unfortunately, what we have is this. We have some parties in Canada. Of course, we have a lot more parties there. We have the Green Party and the NDP Party, who we give them an A for the ambition of their climate plan. But when you look at the feasibility, at the nuts and bolts of how they plan to accomplish it, they can't, because they're looking at doing things that the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction over. Those are provincial issues. So then you have parties like our Liberal Party, where they get a B for ambition, but they get an A for feasibility because they know that they can't do what it takes. And so they're going to do everything they can. So we have a similar challenge here in the U.S. Jay Inslee had a really good climate plan, the governor of Washington, but he's not part of the race anymore. And really it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of who takes it seriously and who doesn't. But sadly, very sadly, we don't have a Republican climate plan. And we should have one, because the thermometer is not Democrat or Republican. It doesn't give us a different answer depending on how we vote. We need a Republican climate plan. The most important thing that we are missing right now is a way to cut carbon emissions that people who are on the conservative side of the spectrum can get on board with. And that's why I think Citizens Climate Lobby is such an important group, because they have sponsored a bipartisan climate solutions caucus in the House where there are equal numbers of Republican and Democrat members, and they have proposed a bill to Congress sponsored by Republicans and Democrats to put a price on carbon, which nearly every economist in the world, including the last two who won the Nobel Prize for economics last year, nearly every economist in the world agrees that that is the most cost-effective and efficient way to cut carbon emissions. So if you're going to have a conversation with a politician, I would strongly recommend asking them, are you a member of the Climate Solutions Caucus? And if not, why not? Because it doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican, climate change matters to all of us.
You're listening to KKRN, Wake Up Call, 88.5 FM, and we're on the web at kkrn.org. We've been thrilled to have Dr. Catherine Hayhoe on the show today. Please check out her Facebook page, her YouTube channels, Global Weirding on YouTube, her TED Talk, and check her out if you're in the state of California. November 5th, 6th, and 7th, she will be down at UC Davis and Berkeley and Stanford, and all that information is on her Facebook page. We just have about 1 minute left, and just any final comments, Catherine?
Well, again, the most important thing that any one of us can do about a changing climate is talk about it. So I hope that as you've been listening to our conversation today, that you've learned something that you didn't know before. And I would encourage you to take what you've learned and go out and have one conversation with somebody this week, not about the science, not feeling like you have to explain all the science, but saying, here's why it matters to us in the place where we live, and here's something really interesting that we can do to help fix it.
Thank you, Dr. Hayhoe, and thank you for listening. And next show up is Tom Hartman.
Wouldn't it be wonderful? We could save the world and all simply by collecting up tin cans and empty bottles. We all want to believe it's true, but it don't matter what you do, so long as we continue to burn our way through fossils. Now it should come as no surprise to learn about the ocean's rise. Polar caps are melting with every year that the planet warms. Now people have to understand, we're gonna feel it far inland. It's gonna shift the seasons and supercharge the storm.